Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spider. So first off, thanks to all the reach out after last week's podcast, where I kind of tried to convince, but didn't really try to convince people to check out the Pleuridae or the curtain web spiders. I personally love them, but I know that a lot of folks steer away from them. One of the reasons I did that was I've mentioned before that there were a lot of the species of true spiders or Pleuridae that I ignored for many, many years because I unfortunately believed they were quote unquote a lot more dangerous than they really are. So for example, we talked about the fact that I avoided wandering spiders for quite some time because I thought they were all like Brazilian wandering spiders, where they were not only just fast, but potentially defensive and had a bite that could easily put you in the hospital, possibly even kill you. And it was the same thing with the Pleuridae. I had seen Linotheli species offered before, but they look like they were big, they look like they were fast, and then they were often called funnel web spiders. And now whenever you hear funnel web spiders, you think of a species that could be, again, potentially deadly, in the very least, put a severe hurting on you. So I avoided those for quite some time. And what I wanted to do with this one is just kind of open the eyes of some folks that were maybe like myself, that had they had the correct information. Now I have to admit, I didn't do a lot of research on them, and that was part of the problem. I just read a few things and went, nope, these aren't for me. And it wasn't until way later where a couple buddies of mine started keeping them, and like, no, they're really not that bad, that I gave them a try, did more research, figured out they're not that bad. So I'm glad a lot of folks, a couple folks chimed in on the actual podcast through Spotify on the website, and I had a bunch of folks on YouTube that said they had actually listened to it. And some folks are now giving them a shot, which is great, because I do think that you guys, that for the folks that try them, I think you'll be impressed with them. I mean, we love large spiders. Most of us love a lot of webbing. They have so much to offer. So I'm glad I did that one. I'm glad that the response was good, because sometimes when I do things that don't involve tarantulas, the interest isn't there. And I get it, because folks are coming to me for the tarantula information, not necessarily this stuff. But I do feel like as I branch out and start keeping more spiders, different spiders, true spiders, the Pleuridae, that I spread what I find out there so folks can make an informed decision of their own, decide if it's something they want to keep. So really glad that I did that one. Today, we're going to have some fun. We're going to go and do the tarantula test or a tarantula assessment part three. I struggled with this one a bit. Not struggled, but trying to come up with questions that aren't species specific can be rather difficult, because it's not fair. Bottom line, if you haven't kept the species or aren't currently researching a species, it could be very difficult to know this very specific information about them. So when trying to come up with test items, I basically looked at some of the titles of the podcasts I've done. I tried to make a list of some of the things I thought that would be important to talk about, because again, part of this is fun. Everybody loves taking tests and quizzes. You get them in magazines. I don't know if you're like me, you end up going down the rabbit hole finding a bunch of online tests or quizzes that you end up taking a bunch of them, and they're fun, they're entertaining, but they also give me a nice platform to address some issues that may pop up in the hobby. So this time around, it's not all based on tarantula husbandry. The last one had some non-husbandry questions in it, but I tried to look at the big picture, some of the things we talked about, and tried to really break out some good questions I think would give people some food for thought and something to think about. And I think in some cases, people are going to be like, oh yeah, I know all this, and it's because we've probably discussed it quite a bit on here, or you've done your research other areas, you know your stuff. But I'm hoping for some people, especially we attract a lot of new people to the podcast. I can't tell you every week that goes by, I have somebody email or leave a comment and introduce themselves saying they just found the podcast, they're going through the whole thing, and a lot of them are brand new to the hobby. So I love to revisit these kind of things for folks who are just getting in, so they can avoid some of these pitfalls ahead of time. If they're aware of them, they can avoid them because they've already heard about them and know what to do in these situations. So again, as I've discussed in previous ones, what we will do is I will read all the questions. I think there are 18 of them this time. I had originally 14, then I added a few more. I was kind of having fun. At first, it was a struggle because I had to go back and reference a lot of the things I wanted to cover I'd already done in part one and part two. And so I would come up with a really good idea. I'd go back and go, it's too close to this question in part one, or pretty much did that one in part two. But then once I got going, it was great because I got a couple YouTube comments, a couple emails once again that kind of went jogged my memory and went, oh, this is something I haven't covered before, and I was able to do that. And again, what we do is I read out the question, we go all the way through, and then I will go back and we will take the questions one at a time and we will answer them. And again, if you find it, last couple times we did this, I had some things that I wanted to cover that I thought answered the question. So, like sometimes there's multi-parts, like what are some things that could be happening here? And folks would chime in with stuff that I hadn't thought thought of, which is great, because that's one of the cool things about putting something like this online. You get to see all different perspectives. You get to hear a bunch of different people give their feedback on it. As always, if it's something you've experienced, please feel free to chime in with it. I love the comments that basically back up and say, yep, I've experienced this. This is what I did, or here's something that I went through. And some of these are actually things that I've experienced, and I will talk about that when the time comes. So enough talking. Let's do tarantula. I guess it's, what was the last one? We had 101, we had 202, I think. I guess 303. I don't know how it goes, but this is part three of it. I hope you enjoy. Here we go. Scenario one. Basically, what it's going to be is a bunch of scenarios, and there'll be a question to go along with the scenario. So question number one, or scenario number one. Santiago is price shopping and discovers that the Spider Superstore ships through FedEx, and shipping is a whopping $50. He finds the same exact spiders at Bargain Arachnids, and shipping is only $20 through U.S. Post. Which dealer should he go with, and why? All right, number two. Candy has been in the hobby for a while, and she has decided that she would like to do some breeding in the future. While shopping around, she finds a vendor offering an awesome deal on an immature breeding pair of Harpactera pulchripes. For just $200, she can get a 1.5-inch or 3.8-centimeter sexed male and a 1.5-inch sexed female. What is the issue with this purchase? Number three. Joyce lives in California, and she decides to buy some spiders from Velvet Spiders in Georgia. On a whim, she picks up one of their party packs, which includes three mystery spiders. When she opens the box, she is elated to discover that one of the spiders is a hard-to-get Piscelotheria vittata. What is wrong with this situation? Number four. Justin finds a vendor at his local pet expo that is selling a sexed adult female OBT or P. murinus. He gets his spider home and sets it up as he would any other terrestrial. For an enclosure, he uses a Sterilite box that measures about 14 inches long by 10 inches wide by 5 inches high, or 35.6 by 25.4 by 12.7 centimeters high. He gives it 2 inches or 5 centimeters of dry substrate, a cork bark hide, and a water dish. After a month, his spider has done some webbing, but it hasn't settled into its new home. Whenever Justin opens up the enclosure, his spider either races around the enclosure or stands its ground in a threat posture. What might the issue be? Number five. Billy arrives home from work to discover that her favorite spider, a 7-inch or 18-centimeter Pamphibidius antinus, has flipped over for a molt. While shining a flashlight into the enclosure, she realizes that she hasn't moistened the substrate down in quite some time, and she never put the water dish back in after taking it out to clean it a couple months earlier. Panicking, she quickly opens the enclosure and pours in some water to moisten the substrate. Thank gosh, she thinks, as she realizes that she just narrowly avoided disaster by keeping her molting tarantula too dry. Why is Billy's optimism unfounded? Number six. Bailey finds an adult female H. gigas for sale and immediately searches for the perfect enclosure. She finds a simple glass reptile tank that measures 14 inches by 9 inches by 6 inches, or 35.6 by 23 by 15.25 centimeters tall, that she thinks will make a great home for it. Although it doesn't have cross ventilation, there is plenty of air flow through the screen top. She sets it up with about 3 inches of moist cocoa fiber substrate, 2 cork bark hides, a water dish, and some moss. What are a few potential issues with this setup? Number seven, Adam finally has his dream spider, a 5-inch or 12.7 centimeter female A. geniculata. He has done his research, so he sets his new spider up in a 12-inch or 30.5 centimeter Exoterra mini cube with about 6 inches or 15.25 centimeters of substrate, a pothos plant, 2 choices of cork bark hides, some sphagnum moss, and a water dish. The setup looks amazing, so he wants it to be the centerpiece of his living room. He places the enclosure on a coffee table in front of the picture window and is immediately amazed by how natural it looks in the midday sunlight. What is the issue with this setup? Number 8. Ross is playing with his labradoodle Bear when he notices some strange movements from his tarantula enclosure shelf. Taking one of the enclosures down, he places it on the table next to his oil diffuser. He sees that his beloved Bee Amelia is moving very sporadically, almost like she can't control her own limbs. He is heartbroken as he watches the poor girl struggle to move, and after doing some quick research, he thinks that she is showing signs of DKS. She was acting totally fine yesterday when he handled her. What could have caused this? Number 9. April absolutely adores her brand new adult female Brachypelma Smithy. She is not only a gorgeous spider, but her previous owner said that she is super docile. April decides that she would like to hold her, so she gets a paintbrush and tries to use it to gently prod her into her open hand. As soon as the brush touches her abdomen, she wheels around and latches onto it with her legs and fangs before letting it go and scampering away. As April tries to calm herself down, she is upset that this new tarantula is obviously aggressive. What is the issue with April's conclusion? Number 10. Although Robbie's wife is arachnophobic, she has finally agreed to let him get some tarantulas. As part of their compromise, they agree that Robbie will only be able to get as many spiders as he can fit in their 3-foot by 3-foot closet. It isn't long before Robbie discovers just how addictive the hobby is, and he soon amasses a collection of around 50 spiders. Knowing that he only has so much space, he only has 3 adult specimens, which he keeps on one shelf. The rest of his collection is composed of slings, which he keeps on the other 2 shelves. Robbie has been particularly enamored with the giants lately, and he is currently raising several Theraphosa, Formictopus, Pamphibidius, and Zanesthus slings. What is the problem with this situation? Number 11. Madison is out shopping when she decides to visit her local mom and pop's pet store to pick up some dog food. After saying hello to Gladys, one of the co-owners of the shop, Madison notices that the pet store now has a small selection devoted to arachnids, and they have several species of tarantulas for sale. Her excitement soon turns to horror when she sees how the spiders are being kept. They have an adult female C. lividus or cobalt blue in a dry Spartan tank with a heat lamp on it. They also have several Brachypelma Smithy juveniles in deli cups with sopping wet substrate and several crickets running around them. Finally, she sees what looks like an H. maculata adult with a sign that says, "Makes a great pet." Disgusted, Madison leaves the store without her dog food and vows never to shop there again. How could she have handled this differently? Number 12. Luis absolutely loves his Gramostola pulchra sling and can't wait until it grows up into a big ebony adult. After eating well for several months, his spider buries itself under several inches of substrate and prepares the molt. Luckily for Luis, the spider has made its burrow right next to the glass so he can still see it. Finally, his spider molts and Luis can't wait for it to resurface so that he can feed it again. However, after 4 weeks go by and the spider still hasn't resurfaced, Luis becomes worried. He can see the spider in its burrow and it looks super thin. What should he do? Number 13. Caroline has been doing her research and she's finally ready to get her first tarantula. She attends a local reptile convention and discovers a snake dealer who is selling a few tarantulas. She finds a young adult labeled Giant Red Knee Female on sale for $50 and snatches it up. A few months later, her new spider molts, and Carolina is initially thrilled with its new bright colors and its large, leggy appearance. However, her excitement turns to worry when the spider hardens up and immediately begins wandering around the enclosure, often refusing to eat. What might the issue be here? It's the big day. Phil has to rehouse his 3-inch or 7.6 centimeters Chilobrachys guangxiensis into its adult enclosure. He currently has it in a 32-ounce deli cup, which is much too small for it. He's putting it into an 18-inch by 12-inch by 12-inch or 46 by 30.5 by 30.5 centimeter enclosure filled with about 6 inches of moist substrate. Phil carefully digs out his spider and then tries to get it to move out into the new enclosure by guiding it with a paintbrush. Suddenly, the spider gets startled and bolts. While Phil looks on helplessly, the spider runs from the cup, races around the outside of the new enclosure twice, and then miraculously bolts back into its old enclosure. Phil's hands are shaking, and he is sweating profusely as he tries to regain his composure. The little hiccup has him completely shaken. What should Phil do? Number 15. Monica is excited to order her first ever tarantulas. She has done her research, read the reviews, and has chosen the online dealer Aaron's Arachnids to make her purchase from. She orders a P. cancerides and a G. pulchropes sling, and she is elated to see that they offer overnight shipping. Soon, she'll be the proud owner of 2 awesome spiders. When she wakes up the next morning, she decides to take off work so that she can make sure that she is there when her spiders arrive. However, as the hours tick by and she doesn't receive a delivery, her elation turns to anger. She checks her email and discovers one from Aaron's Arachnid sent the day of her order that says that her spiders won't be shipped until Monday. Livid that they lied about overnight shipping, she angrily cancels her order. Who is wrong here and why? Number 16. Brian is new to the hobby and has been watching a lot of YouTube videos. His favorite YouTuber has been running ads and opening up free gift boxes from a brand new tarantula dealer called Dusty's Tees. He reads the comments on the videos, and every single one of them seems to be positive. It appears that Dusty's Tees is the place to buy tarantulas, as this YouTuber obviously wouldn't promote a shady business. Assured that the place is reputable, he immediately races to the website and places a huge order. Why is Brian's thinking here wrong? Number 17. Tim lives in Florida and is starting a modest tarantula collection. He has an extra room in his house that doesn't have air conditioning, so he thinks that this would be a great place to keep his spiders. After doing some research, he picks up a juvenile Avicularia versicolor and a Lasiodora parahibana. He reads that both of these spiders need some humidity and higher temperatures. Luckily, the room he is keeping them in is usually around 80 degrees, so he has the perfect temps. As for the moisture requirements, he read a couple of care sheets that said they need moist substrate, water dishes, and to be sprayed at least twice a week. He sets both spiders up a moist sub and is careful to spray down their enclosures every other day. Where is Tim going wrong here? And finally, number 18. Rosa is shopping at Petco and she notices that they are selling tarantulas. When she checks out what they have to offer, she is excited to see that they have an adult female curly hair tarantula on sale for $70. She snatches the spider up, sets it up in an appropriate enclosure, and is super pleased with her purchase. Several weeks later, she notices the spider digging out its burrow and seemingly doing some heavy webbing. She is shocked a few days later to find that her girl has an egg sac. After doing some research, she comes to the conclusion that this is a phantom sac, as she has never paired her lady, and she considers pulling the sac and tossing it in the garbage. Why shouldn't she do this? All right, so there's our 18 questions to start with. I don't know how you folks, I've seen folks that send me pictures of these. They're actually writing them down as they go, which I think is super cool. Do know, guys, that I can't grade them myself. I do want to put this out there because last time I had a couple people send me basically PDFs of this and ask me to grade them. And I'm sorry, I don't have the time to do it. That's just why we're self-grading here. We're doing it on the honor system. So let's kick it off. Let's go back to question number one. And what I will do is I will read the questions again. So that'll give you a second chance to hear it. Second chance to possibly make any changes if you didn't hear it correctly, because I know it can be difficult to just hear these and not see them. I'm personally somebody that would want to see it right in front of me so that I can kind of process it a little bit better, but this is the best I can do. And at some point I will put these up on the website, probably both on my regular website, Tom's Big Spiders, and on Tom's Big Spiders podcast, so that people that do want to print them out and try it that way can print them out, write their answers down, and then go through the actual podcast to hear if they are correct or not, or if there's a different way of looking at it. So for number one, we have Santiago price shopping. He discovers that the Spider Superstore ships through FedEx and shipping is a whopping $50. He finds the same spiders at Bargain Arachnids and shipping is only $20 through US Post. Which dealer should he go with and why? Well, I'm hoping this was pretty, this was a softball, I think, because we've discussed this a couple times now. Folks overseas, this isn't going to mean the same thing, but please chime in if there is a similar type situation or something comparable over there. The answer is he should go with the first store shipping through FedEx because shipping through US Post is still illegal. Yes, people do it. Yes, people have done it for years and got away with it. But in the grand scheme of things, to the letter of the law, it is illegal to ship venomous arachnids through the US mail. That includes spiders or tarantulas. So a lot of folks run into this issue where they'll find somebody that's shipping super, super cheaply. And I hear a lot of folks that complain about the cost to ship through FedEx. Unfortunately, when you ship these animals, you want to ship them overnight. That's the safest way to do it. It's a lot of places that's what their lag involves in you getting them overnight, and then they will cover the animal if it dies in a certain period. And $50 is actually quite cheap compared to what it can cost. So I hear a lot of folks complain and bemoan the cost of shipping spiders. Believe me, I get it. But I think that's why a lot of us, when we shop, try to get as many things as we can to offset that. So if you're buying one spider, $50 is a lot of money. I totally get it. If you're buying 10 spiders, it kind of breaks down between the 10 and suddenly it's not so bad. So in this instance, Santiago should definitely go with the Spider Superstore, the one shipping through FedEx. Number two, Candy has been in the hobby for a while and she has decided that she would like to do some breeding in the future. While shopping around, she finds a vendor offering an awesome deal on an immature breeding pair of Harpactra pulchripes. For just $200, she can get a 1.5-inch sex male and a 1.5-inch sex female. That's 3.8 centimeters for folks out there that do that. What is the issue with this? I see this a lot. Folks are getting excited about breeding and they find deals on breeding pairs. The problem with this situation is, especially with this species, it can differ from species to species, but with certain species, the male is going to mature way earlier than the female. So if he bought two Harpactra pulchripes at the same size, 1.5 inches, a few more molts, that male is going to be mature and running around looking for a lady. The lady will not be ready yet. And this holds true for many different species of tarantulas. Now, sure, folks that are really good at breeding know how to sex them out earlier, or in this case, obviously, they know what sex is, and they keep the male a little cooler. They don't feed it as much. They kind of hold back the male while they feed the female and try to get her to breeding age. Can that be done? Yes. So when somebody chimes in and goes, well, you can do it. The problem is most people aren't thinking that way. What happens is they go out, they buy these two spiders, they're excited, they can't wait to get them up to breeding size, they're feeding them both on the same schedule. Next thing you know it, male molts, he's a good 4 inches long, ready to roll, female's still 3 inches, nowhere near breeding size. So keep an eye on that when you see males and females offered. If you're looking to buy a pair together, look for a situation where the female is much more well along in her growth cycle, larger, and that the male is much smaller. And even then, it can be tricky. I once bought what was sold as Formictopus species blue. God only knows what it is because nobody turned out blue. But in that situation, the female was already about 3.5 inches. The male was about 1.25 inches. The male, long before the female was ready to breed, molted out, was mature, and by the time the female had molted and was at the right size to pair, the male had already passed. So just keep that in mind when you're shopping for it, something that most people don't realize, and you can probably save yourself a little bit of money rather than, especially if you're planning on breeding them, then buying two that are the exact same size and ending up with a mature male that a lot of folks will end up having to trade off or sell off to go breed elsewhere. Number three, Joyce lives in California and she decides to buy some spiders from Velvet Spiders in Georgia. On a whim, she picks up one of their party packs, which includes three mystery spiders. When she opens the box, she is elated to discover that one of the spiders is a hard-to-get Pisolotheria vittata. What is wrong with this situation? Well, you guys have heard me talk about it before. It's popped up quite a bit. Sadly, it still sounds like it's happening, but there are Sri Lankan Pisolotheria species in the United States. That includes Fasciata, Ornata, Smithy, Subfusca, both versions, and the Vittata. They are illegal to sell across state lines. You can't sell these guys across state lines. You can give them away for legitimate breeding loans. You can gift them a legitimate gift, which means no strings attached. So when somebody gifts you something, they don't tell you, hey, if you buy a bunch of stuff for me, I will gift this to you. It doesn't work that way. So when they are included in gift boxes or mystery boxes, it is still illegal. I want to make that very clear because, again, it still happens and people are still confused by it. Luckily, there are some folks out there that were doing this that turned around, recognized that, hey, not a good deal, and they were gifting them. They were shipping them separately. There was a letter in it saying, this is a gift. There are no strings attached. That's what it has to be. So I want to make that clear because I think what happens is folks hear that, hey, it's being given away as a freebie or it's being given away as part of a mystery box, and maybe that's the free one in the mystery box. It doesn't work that way because it's part of commerce. It's part of a transaction that involved money. You can't have money exchanged for a gift. That's not how gifts work. So that would be the issue with that one. Number four, Justin finds a vendor at his local pet expo that is selling a sexed adult female OBT or P. murinus. He gets his spider home and sets it up as he would any other terrestrial. For an enclosure, he uses a Sterilite box that measures 14 inches long by 10 inches wide by 5 inches tall. He gives it 2 inches or 5 centimeters of dry substrate, a cork bark hide, and a water dish. After a month, his spider has done some webbing, but it hasn't settled into its new home. Whenever Justin opens up the enclosure, his spider either races around the enclosure or stands its ground in a threat posture. What might the issue be? Well, if anybody's paying attention to the dimensions of these, which in centimeters, 35.6 by 25.4 by 12.7 centimeters deep, the dimensions of this do not allow for A, enough substrate, or B, enough room for the webbing. This is a spider that when you open it up is going to feel immediately exposed because with that 2 inches of substrate, that only leaves about 3 inches or so between that spider and the top opening. So whenever you open that up, if the spider can't dig, it's going to web. That webbing is going to be right up to the top. So you're going to be peeling off the webbing every time you open it. And until the spider can create enough webbing that it feels like that it can safely and adequately hide in that area, you're going to have a defensive or scared spider. So what you're seeing here is not aggressive behavior. You're seeing a spider that it might be a little bit defensive and skittish because it feels exposed. So when setting up spiders like this, I always say for old worlds, put them in much deeper enclosures that you would a quote unquote terrestrial, because even if you want to give them more substrate, you want to give them that opportunity to burrow. My OBTs, my P. murinus, some of them will actually do quite a bit of burrowing. Some of them won't, but then they'll web up top. You want to give them a chance to do both. So give them an enclosure that offers enough depth that you can put in good 4, 5, 6 inches of substrate in there, some hides, some starter burrows, and then you can put in some plants or branches or something for them to web to so they can web to and give them enough depth so that when they do web, inevitably, you take off that enclosure. You're not just ripping the top off their house and scaring the spider. That's important. And then there's other species that holds true with as well. GBB is another one. I know a lot of folks out there will talk about they are true terrestrial spiders. Well, they've been found sometimes 6 feet off the ground in the wild. They will come up off the ground. And if you want to give them a little extra room for the webbing, some space to go up. We're not talking about setting them up like full arboreals. I want to make that very clear, but we'll call it terrestrial plus. You want to give them some room up top, some stuff to web to, and they will create wonderful little web burrows, which you'll either sit on top of or scoot right into when they're startled. So that would be the situation here with one that could burrow or do some heavy webbing. Give them room up top to create that web. Number 5, Billy arrives home from work to discover their favorite spider, a 7-inch or 18-centimeter Pamphlebedius antinus, is flipped over for a molt. While shining a flashlight into the enclosure, she realizes that she hasn't moistened the substrate down in quite some time, and she never put the water dish back in after taking it out to clean it a couple months earlier. Panicking, she quickly opens the enclosure and pours some water in to moisten the substrate. Thank gosh, she thinks, as she realizes that she just narrowly avoided disaster by keeping her molting tarantula too dry. Why is Billy's optimism unfounded? I hear this one a lot. And it's unfortunately, it's one of those situations where too little, too late. If your spider is a moisture-dependent species, if it's a larger spider, it's going to need moisture before it molts. It needs to drink. It needs, as when we talked to Dr. Andy Anderson about the molt process, they drink because they create a layer of fluid that goes between the two exoskeletons, the one that's going to be shed and the new one forming underneath. And if they don't have enough fluid, it jeopardizes this whole process. So what happens is people will see their spiders molting and go, oh, my spider's getting ready to molt, or my spider's flipped, so I added a bunch of moisture. It's too late at that point. They don't just absorb the water at that point. This spider should have been kept moist before it ever flipped and went into pre-molt. It should have had access to water when it was in pre-molt. Adding the water now is too late. So unfortunately, I've heard many situations of folks that they see it's flipped, they start pouring the water in, they pour some water in the water dish, but before that it was dry, so they didn't get the water they needed in time. So it's always important to recognize, keep those water dishes full. I think that's a big thing. That's kind of a safety net in case things dry out a little bit. I have had situations myself where I look into an enclosure and I notice, oh crud, the substrate's dried out a bit, but luckily there's a water dish in there, and I have seen spiders come out and get a drink or hang around the water dish when things get too dry. But unfortunately, in this situation here, hopefully the molt with her P. antinus goes well, but by the sounds of things, she was not timely in keeping that tarantula hydrated. So always make sure if it's a moisture-dependent species or one of the big tropical ones that they have that moist spot, that they have access to water, you don't let them dry out, and try to keep in mind that if they're already flipping or they're heavy into pre-molt and then you decide to add moisture in there, it may be too late. Number 6, Bailey finds an adult female H. gigas for sale and immediately searches for the perfect enclosure. She finds a glass reptile tank that measures 14 inches by 9 inches by 6 inches, or 35.6 by 23 by 15.25 centimeters tall, that she thinks will make a great home for it. Although it doesn't have cross ventilation, there is plenty of airflow through the screen top. She sets it up with about 3 inches of moist cocoa fiber substrate, 2 corkbark hides, a water dish, and some moss. What are 2 potential issues with this setup? So just off the bat, for folks that aren't familiar with this species, the H. gigas is a moisture-dependent species. It's also a burrowing species. So there's a couple clues of things to be looking for. Give you a second to mull that over as we now get into the answer. All right, that's enough time. You can always pause this if you wanted to. So here are the issues, and there are actually 3 with this one. Although I said 2 in the other one, there's actually 3 different things to consider. Number one, the most obvious, it's a fossorial species. 3 inches is not enough substrate for that one to burrow and create a good burrowing system. So the substrate right off the bat is much too shallow. Number two, she used cocoa fiber, which cocoa fiber isn't bad on its own, but I will tell you 3 inches of moist cocoa fiber, once it dries out, and it will dry out, we'll talk about that in a moment, is going to become about an inch, maybe even less of cocoa fiber. Cocoa fiber is much more fluffy, expands more when it's moist, but it also dries out very, very quickly. Years ago, this is why I moved away from using cocoa fiber, because I was starting to get a lot of fossorial species, and I was realizing I would fill this thing up with moist substrate, fill the container up, 8-9 inches of moist substrate. Within a year, it was down to like 3 inches of substrate. And although it does absorb moisture very, very quickly, that's one of the things I like about cocoa fiber. If you pour water in, it sucks it right up like a sponge. It also releases it much more quickly. So there's not enough substrate, not especially for using cocoa fiber. If you'd fill that thing very near close to the top, use cocoa fiber, it would probably work. It would give it enough room. They will web up. Cocoa fiber, I know, has a reputation for not being stable because it's fluffy, but they do web up their burrows. And even if it does collapse, they'll just redig them out and web them up. The other thing that's wrong with this is the screen top. And there's a couple issues. Number one, screens, we know with terrestrials, especially terrestrial tarantulas, they can get their toe claws caught in them and become lodged in and trapped. That's something to consider. So when she's got this spider in there, I can tell you right now, there's not enough room for it to adequately hide. It may wander around to try to find a better spot, end up upside down on the top and get caught. So that's a safety issue. Number two, that screen top, things that ventilate through the top, it's good ventilation, obviously great ventilation, but know that things will evaporate even more quickly when there's top ventilation. So what's going to happen with that 3 inches of cocoa fiber? That is going to dry out much too quickly with that screen top. So that's something to think about there. So there would obviously need to be some tweaks. If she went ahead, added more cocoa fiber to it or more substrate, that would help. If she went and replaced the screen top with some drilled plexiglass, that would help a great deal. It would not only reduce the risk posed by that screen top, but it would also cut down a little bit of the airflow. Again, we're not trying to stop airflow. It's just having that screen top is like having the thing wide open. So it would cut down a little bit, probably would keep that substrate for drying out too quickly, but some definitely would need to be some changes there to make this an appropriate home for this particular species. Number seven, Adam finally has his dream spider, a 5-inch or 12.7 centimeter female A. geniculata. He has done his research, so he sets his new spider up in a 12-inch or 30.5 centimeter Exoterra mini cube with about 6 inches or 15.25 centimeters of substrate, a pothos plant, 2 choices of cork bark hides, some sphagnum moss, and a water dish. The setup looks amazing, so he wants it to be the centerpiece of his living room. He places the enclosure on a coffee table in front of the picture window and is immediately amazed by how natural it looks in the midday sunlight. What is wrong with this setup? Well, this is kind of misleading because it isn't actually the setup itself. The setup itself sounds fantastic. This sounds like a great setup for the species of spider. The issue is coming from having what is a glass enclosure in direct sunlight. This is a picture window. The sun is coming in, beating down on it. It creates a similar situation to locking a pet in a car during the summer. I once did an experiment because I was kind of wondering how much do these things really heat up. And I put a thermometer in one of my tanks, put it in direct sunlight. My Lord, did that jack the heat up inside. So you want to be very careful. I had to do it. I've gone through this with my own new tarantula room. I have 2 skylights opposite of where the cages are. And at first in the wintertime, it didn't seem like a problem because the sunlight wasn't directly hitting any of the cages. But then when summer came, the sun was beating right down on those skylights and it was hitting some of the enclosures and heating them up. So you have to be careful of where you place your enclosures, especially if they're glass or acrylic, to make sure that they don't heat up in the sun. And I have had several instances over the years where folks have contacted me like, listen, my spider seems to be very listless. I don't get it. It's not doing well. And we would look at pictures and realize, oh, it's because the sun is beating down and kind of frying the spider. So always be careful. We've talked about before, we had a previous question, I think, that involved the spider being in a room in the wintertime where a door was opening and a draft is coming through. Positioning of enclosures is very important. You have to give it some thought. Sometimes it takes experimentation. Like I said, sometimes you get something at a certain time of the year, there's no problem. Sun comes out in the summertime and all of a sudden it's an issue. So it can be one of those things where you set up your whole shelf in your living room. It's fantastic during the winter months. And then summertime comes and this isn't going to work. We need to cover the window with a shade, or we need to move those shelves. So always be aware of that whenever you're setting your spiders up, that they are not being baked by direct sunlight. That can be a terrible situation. It can lead to the desiccation and death of the spider. Number 8. Ross is playing with his Labradoodle Bear when he notices some strange movements from his tarantula enclosure shelf. Taking one of the enclosures down, he places it on the table next to his oil diffuser. He sees that his beloved Bee Amelia is moving very sporadically, almost like she can't control her own limbs. He is heartbroken as he watches the poor girl struggle to move, and after doing some quick research, he thinks that she is showing signs of DKS. She was acting totally fine yesterday when he handled her. What could have caused this? So anybody that listened to the two-part podcast with Dr. Andy Anderson about signs of DKS and some of the causes of it should immediately recognize two possibilities here. Number one, the oil diffuser. I did not realize this. I had often said the burning candles was fine, but I actually had no knowledge of oil diffusers until very recently. It's not something we have in the Moran household, but some of the essential oils that they burn in there can be actually hazardous to tarantulas, and Dr. Andy Anderson has seen evidence that these oil diffusers can actually cause DKS in spiders. You've seen instances where spiders are showing those signs, and somebody was running an oil diffuser in the same house, and that makes a lot of sense. There is another one here that we don't know for sure, but could be a possibility. He is wrestling with his Labradoodle Bear in the beginning. That means he's petting it, ruffling up its fur, and if he uses one of those ointments that you use to treat flea and ticks, whether it be a collar, whether it be Frontline, that oil you put down their spine and it absorbs in, that could be causing the issues. We found out that the stuff that they use, active ingredient that they use for those types of flea and tick treatments, can be deadly to spiders. I talked about how I had a case of DKS many, many years ago. I actually put one of the first videos I put up on YouTube, try to show people what to look for. And as it turns out, we were using Frontline to treat my dogs at that time. I was petting my dogs. I had that stuff on my hands. I handled some prey items. I put the prey item in with the spider. And the spider got basically poisoned by that, which is horrific to think of. So that's another issue there. It sounds like he holds a spider, so there was contact. We don't know if he's held food items, but there's two different issues there that we may think about. So that's something that, unfortunately for this Bee Amelia, if it is DKS, it usually ends up being fatal. He will probably lose that spider, but there is obviously a very important lesson to be learned here. And hopefully in a situation like this, if this happens to anybody, this is the type of troubleshooting you should do to try to figure out what might have caused it. It took me years to figure out what killed my spider and how it got DKS. But now that I know, obviously we had an idea back then that it might have been due to it was the only thing I could come up with, might have been due to the Frontline that we're using on the dog. So we actually switched to an oral one, but that's something to always consider for people that have pets or do run oil diffusers. It could impact or negatively impact the health of your spiders. Number 9. April absolutely adores her brand new adult female Brachypelma Amelia. She's not only a gorgeous spider, but her previous owner said that she is super docile. April decides that she would like to hold her, so she gets out a paintbrush and tries to use it to gently prod her into her open hand. As soon as the brush touches her spider, she wheels around and latches onto it with her legs and fangs before letting it go and scampering away. As April tries to calm herself down, she is upset that this new tarantula is obviously aggressive. What is the issue with April's conclusion? So hopefully everybody here recognized the fact that this wasn't a spider being quote unquote aggressive. It wasn't even a spider probably being defensive. What it sounds like happened here was a feeding response. Spiders can have very violent feeding responses. A lot of times they're in what we like to refer to as standby mode, where they're sitting there. They don't seem to recognize anything's going on around them. Sometimes you'll open the top of the enclosure, the spider won't even budge. Sometimes there'll be prey items running around them. They're not even moving until suddenly it's like, oh, wait a minute, food. And then they jump on it. And it sounds here like the spider spider, when she touched it in the butt, it wasn't attacking her per se. It thought it was a food item. It was jumping on it, leaping on the food item, trying to grab it. And how we know that is the spider eventually lets it go and scampers away. What'll end up happening is if they bite and then they realize this thing's a heck of a lot bigger than a food item, they will often run away because they realize they made a mistake. I mean, they don't realize we're kind of anthropomorphizing here, but the spider recognizes it's not a prey item, lets go and runs away. So I hear a lot of situations where people will message me and they're all upset because they went to hold their spiders. And again, we're not getting at the holding thing here. This is for folks who do hold and they attack the brush. Well, A, that's one of the reasons why you always want to try it with a brush first, because if that had been her hand, she would have been bitten. She probably would have been terrified of that spider for the rest of her life. So you test their temperament with the brush. And again, even if the spider attacks the brush, it doesn't mean that the spider is mean or defensive. It's probably trying to eat. I've shared the story many times of how I tried to hold the queen years ago. I got a feeding response out of her and I passed out because it just scared the living heck out of me. And I was lucky enough to recognize at that time that she wasn't going at me because she was attacking me. She hadn't been fed in a while. She was thinking it was a prey item. And when I'm thinking back on it, she attacked and then immediately scampered away like, oop, nope, never mind. So keep that in mind when you're working with spiders, whether you're trying to handle them, or I just had a recent video with an Avicularia avicularia that the Avicularia species jumped on the brush, attacked it, did the same thing, ran off. And at first I thought it had been a defensive maneuver, but after rewatching it a couple times, I realized it had attacked it because it thought it was a prey item. When it realized it wasn't a prey item, it ran away. So always keep that in mind. I think a lot of the spiders out there that have a reputation for being defensive or, oh, I hate the word, aggressive, that's what you're seeing a good feeding response. One that immediately comes to mind is Acanthoscuria janiculata. For years, I read about how they could be so feisty and so nasty. No, they just have amazing feeding responses. I've never seen a threat posture from any of mine. They, generally speaking, just like to eat. So if something hits that webbing, they're going at it. So keep that in mind when you're working with the tarantulas. It's not only always or not often that they're trying to harm you. They just think there's food nearby. Number 10, although Robbie's wife is arachnophobic, she finally agreed to let him get some tarantulas. As part of their compromise, they agree that Robbie will only be able to get as many spiders as he can fit in their 3x3-foot closet. It isn't long before Robbie discovers just how addictive the hobby is, and he soon amasses a collection of around 50 spiders. Knowing that he only has so much space, he only has 3 adult specimens, which he keeps on one shelf. The rest are all slings, which he keeps on the other 2 shelves. Robbie has been particularly enamored with the giants lately, and he's currently raising several Theraphosa, Formictopus, Pamphibidius, and Zanestis slings. What is the problem with this situation? I think a lot of us have been in Robbie's shoes before. It tends to be quite a common problem with the tarantula hobby. People find the hobby, they have a certain amount of room they want to keep spiders in, they come up with a list of ones they want to keep, and then they realize, hey, slings don't take up a heck of a lot of room, so I can actually get a lot of slings, so I can get more spiders than I ever planned on. What they don't consider is the space these slings will take up when they reach even juvenile stage, but definitely adulthood. And that's what the issue Robbie is looking at here. They have agreed to keep everything in a 3x3 closet. It sounds like there are 3 shelves in the closet, one of which is already occupied by adult enclosures. And unfortunately, Robbie doesn't have the super slow growing species here. If we are talking about Robbie amassing a collection of a Faunapelma, Gramostola, and Brachypelma species, not really a big issue. There's a very good chance by the time these guys grow up, they've agreed to give Robbie more space. A lot can change in the amount of time it would take those 3 genera of tarantulas to grow up, but that's not what Robbie has here. Robbie has Theraphosa species, Formictopus, Pamphibidus, and Zanestis slings. Depending on how many he has, if he has multiple of each species, you're talking about, and depending how warm he's keeping them, how much he's feeding them, those spiders can easily hit 4 or 5 inches in the first year, meaning they're going to be in basically adult size enclosures within a year. It doesn't sound like from what they're describing, what I'm describing, the sound of the closet, there will be enough room for them. That is something anybody that gets in the hobby has to consider. There's a video out there where Billy bought me a bunch of Zanestis species, and I made a comment in it, well, we're going to need a new house now because I'm going to be out of room. That wasn't really a joke. That was Actually, I had been at my capacity in that room for a while. I couldn't get a lot of big spiders. I was very careful with what I bought. If I lost an adult male, I would go and buy another one for a bigger spider, but I was being very careful. And when we got all those in, I realized that these grow up, there's not going to be enough room. So that actually, legitimately, we were talking about getting a bigger house to begin with, but that kind of kicked the whole thing, kickstarted the whole thing and got us looking. So that is something to be very careful of when you get in the hobby. Be aware of how much room you have and be aware that these spiders you're getting as slings that are only taking up maybe a little corner of the shelf are eventually going to grow up. And I have spoken to many people lately who are incredibly responsible when it comes to that. A couple guys that I correspond with on YouTube, they always leave comments. We go back and forth that have said, this is how many I can have 10 right now. This one just passed from old age. I will get another one because that's the room I have. That's the kind of thinking we all need to have when getting into the hobby. That will keep us from getting into situations where suddenly we don't have enough room. And for the folks that are like, well, Robbie's wife is just going to have to deal with it. He's going to need more room. I hate to say it, as funny as it kind of is to joke like that, they're a married couple. I'm sure they got a lot more going for them than just Robbie's hobby. And bottom line, sometimes we need people to keep us in check. If Billy gave me the whole house to fill with my stuff, I'd probably do it. So it's part of being married is compromising. I know there's always going to be that comment, well, it sounds like Robbie just needs to get rid of his wife. No, if she was nice, if she's arachnophobic and they came to a compromise, he needs to abide by that compromise. So that would be the answer to this one. Be careful with the space you have. Be careful which species you're buying. Always keep that in the back of your mind and make sure you're going to have not just enough room for the slings and juveniles when they're in that stage, but for them when they grow up to adulthood. Number 11. Madison is out shopping when she decides to visit her local mom and pop's pet store to pick up some dog food. After saying hello to Gladys, one of the co-owners of the shop, Madison notices that the pet store now has a small section devoted to arachnids, and they have several species of tarantulas for sale. Her excitement soon turns to horror when she sees how the spiders are being kept. They have an adult female C. lividus or cobalt blue and dry Spartan tank with a heat lamp on it. They also have several Brachypelma smithii juveniles in deli cups with sopping wet substrate and several crickets running around them. Finally, she sees what looks like an H. maculata adult with a sign that says, makes a great pet. Disgusted, Madison leaves the store without her dog food and vows never to shop there again. How could she have handled this differently? I bring this one up because obviously we've had lots of chats. I've heard folks over in the UK say the same thing. There's some issues over there. There's not many pet stores that carry them. Those that do often don't care for them correctly, often put forth the wrong husbandry information for them. We have a huge problem with this in the United States where people pick up the spiders. They don't really care about them. They're more to drag people in with, you know, the curiosity factor. Oh my gosh, they've got tarantulas, and they don't bother to really learn how to take care of them, which I think is quite frankly criminal. If you're running a pet shop and you're keeping animals like this, you should be ashamed of yourself. Do I think there's an excuse for it? No. But there is a line of thinking that when you see something like that, you should walk out, never buy anything from them again, and that's it. And I think we're missing the boat sometimes with that. If we notice in this situation here, she obviously knows the owner. She knows her name is Gladys. They at least have chatted probably before. Just walking out is a wasted opportunity. When it's possible, I mean, would I do this with a Petco or PetSmart, one of the big box stores? It's sometimes worth it. I've heard people that have approached some of the employees there and tried to explain that the care was wrong and have had some positive interactions, have created some change, which is great. They can be a little more difficult with the big stores, but with some of the mom and pop stores, sometimes just approaching the people and volunteering the information or trying to help them out and offering them information of where to go to find stuff can be very, very valuable. You don't want to just walk out and go, forget it, I'm never buying here. Try to reason with them first. I have had good situations myself where I've been able to go into pet stores and talk to people and seen the care improve. I've spoken to many others over the years that have taken the time to go up to employees, to go up to the owners and say, listen, this isn't what you want to do. And they've helped them out. I've heard wonderful situations where not only were the people receptive to it, but they actually kind of put them in charge of the tarantula care, not as official workers, but they've listened to them, allowed them to make changes and whatnot, and have paid them by giving them free spiders or discounted spiders, which is awesome. Everybody wins in that situation. So in this scenario here, I don't think Madison should have immediately stormed out. She should have talked to Gladys calmly. You don't want to do it in a way like, this is absolutely disgusting. You want to break things down. Bring her over to that C. lividus and have her recognize this is a moisture-dependent species. It needs at least, the problem is with the pet store, you got to be able to show the spiders in there, but it at least needs enough moist substrate that it can get a little hide going in there, get the heat lamp off of it. The smithies do not need the sopping wet substrate. try to get them to adjust their care. Because the problem is, yes, I know that our big thing to do in these situations is to not buy there so that we're not promoting it. And I get that, and I agree to an extent. But the problem is, it's not the informed people that are buying these spiders. It's the people that are coming in going, oh my gosh, it's a tarantula. I've never seen one of these before. And they know nothing about it. And then they're buying them. So they're going to get sold either way. The thing to do, I think, in these situations when possible, is to try to reason with the person who owns the place, that runs the place, that is working there. Try to effect some type of change so that they're getting the right care. Next, we have number 12. Luis absolutely loves his grandma's stole poker sling and can't wait until it grows up into a big ebony adult. After eating well for several months, the spider buries itself under several inches of substrate and prepares to molt. Luckily for Luis, the spider has made its burrow right next to the glass so we can still see it. Finally, a spider molts and Luis can't wait for it to resurface so they can feed it again. However, after 4 weeks go by and the spider still hasn't resurfaced, Luis becomes worried. He can see the spider in its burrow and it looks super thin. What should he do? This is one for years we've told people never, ever, ever dig up a spider that is in pre-molt or molting, and I agree to that 98% of the time, but in my own collection over the years, I have seen several instances of spiders burying themselves and not surfacing. The thought process is that some of these guys in the wild, if they dig, they will find prey items under the dirt. I've seen this with the P. muticus. They found out there are certain species of crickets and bugs and grubs that if the P. muticus just keeps digging down deeper and deeper and deeper, it's going to run into prey items. It doesn't have to surface. I just had this happen with an Afanopelma burica. It molted. It didn't open up its burrow. I opened up the burrow a little bit, and I basically put a pre-killed cricket right at the top of the burrow entrance. It came up. It ate it ravenously. While it was still open, I dropped in a couple other live crickets. It ate those, and then it sealed its burrow back up, and I could see that it was still thin, and I was putting crickets on the top. It wasn't coming up to get the cricket, so I had to open up the burrow again. This is something to be aware of, be cognizant of. In this situation, what I encourage people to do is to find where the mouth of the burrow is. I usually like to moisten it down a little bit because it makes the substrate so it won't crumble in and cave in the whole burrow. You moisten the substrate down around that area. Use the back of a paintbrush to gently open up the entrance of that burrow. You kind of take it and pack down the substrate around it so it makes a hold of the burrow. And then take a prey-killed prey item and drop it right in the top of that burrow. And what's going to happen is the spider is going to come up to close the burrow again. And a lot of times what they will do is they will find the prey item and they will eat it. And in that case, you know the spider's eating, so you want to continue to do that. In a lot of cases, like what happened with my Aburica, I'm looking over at her now. She actually, the second time I opened the burrow, she kept it open. So now I can drop live prey in there and she's hunting it. But that's something always to be aware of. And I use the Grandma Stole a Pulcher on this on purpose because I had this exact thing happened with my grandma's stole pulchra. It molted. It was down there a month. It was only about an inch, maybe an inch and a quarter, and it was super, super skinny and was not coming up to eat. So I opened up the top of the burrow carefully, dropped a little dead prey item in there. It was all over it. Never drop live prey items in the burrow. Try not to drop anything in the burrow, because if it's not eating, it's just going to sit there and rot. Sometimes they'll carry it out. But if you put it right at the mouth, it will come up to investigate that the burrow is open. It'll find the prey item and usually it'll eat it. So that's a little tip for ones that you're worried about. Do not put anything, if there's one you're not sure, if it's molting, if it buried itself and you think it might be still molting, never drop anything down there. But opening up a little bit, leaving something dead out there is a good way to try to figure out if it is indeed eating. Number 13, Caroline has been doing her research and she's finally ready to get her first tarantula. She attends a local reptile convention and discovers a snake dealer who is selling a few tarantulas. She finds a young adult labeled Giant Red Knee Female on sale for $50 and snatches it up. A few months later, her new spider molts and Caroline is initially thrilled with its new bright colors and larger leggy size. However, her excitement turns to worry when the spider hardens up and immediately begins wandering its enclosure, often refusing to eat. What might be the issue here? Now, sometimes, let's just get this out of the way. Sometimes spiders molt and they're not particularly pleased with their environment after that. I've seen that happen with a couple things. My O. philippinus, both of them molted, abandoned their burrows and spent a lot more time on the surface. I've had other spiders do that. So this might not necessarily be bad behavior or uncharacteristic behavior for a spider that's just molted. However, there are a few telltale signs here that would lead me to believe that what Caroline has is a mature male. And this happens quite a bit. Number one, she got it from somebody who concentrates on selling snakes. A lot of times, not everybody, so please don't come bombarding me with people, oh, this guy does a great job. Obviously, there's some folks out there that know both, but a lot of folks who deal reptiles and snakes will also carry a few arachnids to kind of attract more people to their table. A lot of them don't know anything about them, and I've experienced this myself, even going to shows myself. So there's a good chance that that female, A, she's lucky it's the right species. B, there's a good chance that that quote-unquote sex female is actually a male. This happens quite a bit. I get a lot. And the reason I put this one on here is I get a lot of folks that will email me or message me, hey, I don't know what's going on with this setup. I bought this spider at a show. It's wandering all around the cage. And I'll look at the cage, like the cage looks good. And then I'll get a close-up of the tarantula and see that it is actually a mature male. So always keep that in the back of your mind. This happens, obviously, more often to folks that are newer to the hobby, but there have been people over the years that have bought from dealers what they thought was a sex female, only to find out later on it's a male. So always consider that alternative, that possibility. It doesn't happen a lot, but if you buy your tarantulas from reputable sources that specialize in selling arachnids, this is less likely to happen. Granted, there are some obvious places out there that it will screw people over, which is sad, but there are also a lot of really good people out there that the reviews are out there to back them up, that they know what they're doing. Number 14, it's the big day. Phil has to rehouse his 3-inch or 7.6-centimeter Kilobrachis guangxiensis into its adult enclosure. He currently has it in a 32-ounce deli cup, which is much too small for it. He's putting it into an 18-inch by 12 by 12-inch or 46 by 30.5 by 30.5-centimeter enclosure filled with about 6 inches of moist substrate. Phil carefully digs out his spider and then tries to get it to move into the new enclosure by guiding it with a paintbrush. Suddenly, the spider gets startled and bolts. While Phil looks on helplessly, the spider runs from the cup, races around the outside of the new enclosure twice, then miraculously bolts back into its old enclosure. Phil's hands are shaking and he's sweating profusely as he tries to regain his composure. The little hiccup has him completely shaken. What should Phil do? I put this one on there because I get folks to tell me about these horror stories of rehousings, and I think we've all had instances where things don't go as planned, we get freaked out, and then we don't want to do the rehousing anymore, and that's completely understandable. But there are a couple things in this scenario here that Phil could do. Number one, if you are so freaked out that you are sweating, you are shaking, you are completely, your heart is beating out of your chest, if the spider is contained, put the cap back on the enclosure, put the top back on the enclosure, the old enclosure, wait and try it again later after you calm down. We've spoken before about rehousings when you're scared, when you've been startled, you don't think as clearly as you need to. You can do panic things, which can involve the spider getting out, which can involve the spider getting injured, which can involve you getting injured. So sometimes it's best when something like that happens to take a step back, calm down, get your nerve, have an adult beverage. All right, I can't say do that, but you know what I'm saying. It's time to just kind of relax a bit. However, there's another thing that he could do here, and a lot of people don't realize you can do this. I've done it many times before, especially when the spider's going nuts. I go, all right, I don't have time for this. You're going to come out on your own. Because it's a 32-ounce deli cup, because there is enough room in the enclosure with the amount of substrate he has there, he could easily put the cap back on the enclosure, the cap back on that 32-ounce deli cup, put the deli cup inside the new enclosure, take the cap off, and let the spider come out on its own. I do this many times. I don't do it a lot in videos because obviously when I'm doing a video, part of the video is being able to show the spider off to people so they can see what they're going to be getting, what the spider looks like. But there have been times where I just take the spider, pop the cap, drop it in there, let it come out on its own. I just did it with a couple of Diplurodi species. They were in their old dram vials. I just took the top off the dram vial, pointed the top of the dram vial toward one of the little pre-started burrows I had for it, and let it come out on its own. It's as easy as that. So there's a couple different ways to go about it here. That's how a keeper should be thinking when something like that goes wrong. If he's so scared that he doesn't feel like, I've heard folks that get so startled by spiders, they can't even hold on to the tongs or the brush because their hands are trembling. In that case, you definitely need to take a break. Relax. Take a breather, come back maybe the next day, try it again. But in this situation here, it sounds like the best way to do it. Sometimes for folks that get startled, they need to jump right back on the horse because if they were stressing about the rehousing already and it went poorly, they're going to perseverate on it to a point where they're going to absolutely dread trying to move the spider again. I've spoken to people who have had something go bad and they've been like, it's 2 months and I'm afraid to even attempt it again. And that's not a good situation. So depending on the Phil's temperament, depending upon his constitution when it comes to dealing with a fright and something not going right, it may be best for him to immediately just take a quick breath, grab that cup, drop it back in the old enclosure, and be done with it. Number 15, Monica is excited to order her first ever tarantulas. She has done her research, read the reviews, and has chosen the online dealer Aaron's Arachnids to make her purchase from. She orders a Pekin Cerates and a G. Polkerpiece sling, and she is elated to see that they offer overnight shipping. Soon, she'll be the proud owner of two awesome spiders. When she wakes up the next morning, she decides to take off from work so that she can make sure that she is there when her spiders arrive. However, as the hours tick by and she doesn't receive a delivery, her elation turns to anger. She checks her email and discovers one from Aaron's Arachnids that was sent the day of her order that says that her spiders won't be shipped until the following Monday. Livid that they lied about overnight shipping, she angrily cancels her order. Who is wrong here and why? Well, I'm hoping this one was fairly obvious, but I literally just got an email and that's why it made it to the list. And this happens quite a bit of somebody complaining about a dealer saying that they ordered the overnight shipping and the next day the spider did not arrive. And unfortunately, the issue here is that all tarantula dealers offer, I believe all tarantula dealers offer overnight shipping because it's the safest way to ship tarantulas. That is the way it's being shipped. They are using the overnight shipping option to make sure the spider goes from point A to point B in 24 hours time so it doesn't spend a lot of extra time in the mail. That's a type of shipping. That does not mean your spider is going to be shipped the next day. I think folks see this and they confuse it with shipping that is going to be there in 24 hours. That's not what it means. It means that your item, when it is shipped, will be shipped using a service that takes 24 hours. This is important because I think a lot of folks hop on these websites, they see that, and they immediately think, I'm going to have my spider tomorrow. And that's normally not how it works. For spider vendors that are doing a decent amount of business, they have shipping days. So for example, some vendors have a rule that they don't ship after anything on Thursday or Friday because if the package does get stuck in the mail and they're using FedEx, then that package could be delayed the entire weekend, which puts the spiders in jeopardy. This is for the safety of the animals. Others, if you order on a Saturday or Sunday, you may get bumped to the next week because they've already got their orders ready to go out the following week. It depends on the dealer, honestly, and it's always something that you should be reading the terms of service and reading the website carefully before you order so that you understand how it works. I get a lot of emails, sadly, from folks, and I'm the one that has to kind of be the bad guy and go, you're the one being unreasonable here. That's not how things work. The other thing is, when you order, you should receive an email where they are going to check where you want it shipped to. You need to respond to that. I've had people that would tell me, hey, I waited 4 days and I didn't get my package. So then I jumped on the email and realized that they sent this. Well, you should have read that immediately. Anytime you order, expect an email confirming your order. Read the email carefully. Make sure you're aware of the lag terms. Make sure you're aware of when they are shipping. Make sure the address is correct. There's been situations where people almost happened to me. Billy and I moved. I had the wrong address on the thing. You want to check all this stuff out. So this is just part of the hobby, part of being responsible when you order tarantulas online to recognize how it works, how the vendors work, how shipping works, and how lags work. And if you're not doing that, if you're just ordering, sending it, expecting the tarantula to come and not reading any of that information, not getting in contact with them when the email asks for a response, then that one's on you. So I do want to put that out there because I just had somebody say that that was an issue that they had with a dealer. And they wanted me to go out there and report that this dealer was not reputable. And I know for a fact the dealer is reputable. So let's make sure that we're reading those things. Very important. And I probably should revisit the whole, I think I did this before, the whole how to purchase a tarantula online thing. But it almost bears repeating because I think people that are new to the hobby, and normally this isn't people that have been around for a while, but I have had this happen with people that have been around for a bit. It's folks who are used to ordering off Amazon where it's 2-day shipping means it's going to be at your door in 2 days. It's not that they're using a means that ships within 2 days and that you still have to wait for them to ship it out. So please be careful of that. Please recognize and understand and read those lags and all of the information that a dealer sends you before you start saying that they're not reputable. Number 16, Brian is new to the hobby and he's been watching a lot of YouTube videos. His favorite YouTuber has been running ads and opening up free gift boxes from a brand new tarantula dealer called Dusty's Tees. He reads the comments on the videos and every single one of them seems to be positive. It appears that Dusty's Tees is the place to buy tarantulas as his YouTuber obviously wouldn't promote a shady business. Assured that the dealer is reputable, he places a huge order. Why is Brian's thinking wrong? This is an important one, and I threw it in there with the dealer one because I still think there's people that don't understand how this whole process works. If, obviously, YouTubers are a great place to go to A, see spiders, B, sometimes get good husbandry information, sometimes not, and C, to learn about those new dealers out there. If you're a new dealer and you're trying to sell tarantulas, the best way to get word out is to send some free stuff to a YouTuber who is going to do an unboxing, which are incredibly popular videos across YouTube, no matter what you're unboxing. It could be action figures, it could be Yu-Gi-Oh cards, it could be Pokemon cards, it could be a plethora of different things. People love unboxing videos. So your product, your new business is going to get a great advertisement. It's going to get in front of a lot of eyes and a lot of eyes of people that are your target audience. These are people that buy tarantulas. But that's what we need to keep in our mind. It's an advertisement. If somebody sends somebody a free box, they are obviously getting great service. They are obviously getting awesome animals. They're not going to do anything to jeopardize their business there. But that doesn't mean that the dealer is reputable. It doesn't mean that the dealer doesn't have issues. It doesn't mean that the dealer is the best place to buy. I think we struggle with that. And I think a lot of times it's folks that are, again, new to the hobby. They find the hobby through YouTubers, which is great because I do think a lot of people that I talk to find tarantulas by watching YouTube videos. Some of them have never even considered keeping tarantulas before in their lives, but then they see somebody showing them off and they go, wow, I want to try this out. And that's awesome. But I don't think they understand that just because somebody's promoting something doesn't mean that it's the best. I think they a lot are under the misconception that these people are buying this with their own money. That's, hey, I just made this purchase and holy crud, it was awesome and I want to show you. No, if you pay attention, a lot of them, they're getting free boxes in. And that's fine. That's how it works. I get it. It's brilliant advertising. It's just the way things work. I guess it's the only way to really put it. I'm not knocking that. What I am knocking is people that will watch that video and immediately go, well, this person says they're good and everybody else is ordering from them. So I want to be part of this club. So I'm going to order from them without doing any other research. And that is not the way to go about it. Why is Brian's thinking wrong? Well, his thinking of finding this new dealer from the YouTuber is not wrong. But by not doing any further research on it, by not hopping on the message boards, Arachna boards, other boards that have reviews of these keepers, by not looking on what's on the Facebook groups, by doing searches on Google to see what type of reviews they're getting, he's really setting himself up. Because a lot of times we have dealers that come out, they get promoted, suddenly they screw over a bunch of people, and everybody's like, oh, I had no idea. And there was a lot of information out there that pointed to there were problems, there were signs. So you always want to do your due diligence, do the research, check, see, are they getting negative reviews? Is one person saying they got the wrong spider? Hey, you know what? It does sometimes happen. Are two people saying they got the wrong spider? Are three people saying that they never got their orders? Are four people saying that they ordered mystery boxes and never received them? Are a bunch of people saying that, hey, you know what? I just ordered a bunch of spiders and now they say they're backed up and they've already missed two deadlines where they were supposed to send them out and I haven't received my spiders. Would I order from somebody like that? Personally, I would not. I would take that as a sign I'm going to back off, and I've done this many times where I back off and kind of wait to see what happens. And a lot of times, unfortunately, when you start seeing like that stuff like that pop up more and more often, there is a problem there. The sad fact is there are people that get into the tarantula vending business that immediately get in over their heads. I've seen it happen time and time again. They might not be terrible people. Some of them are scumbags. I think we've had a couple recent ones that are just totally terrible people. I will call it as it is. But there are some that are good people that they plan to get a shipment in. They got an import coming in. They take a bunch of pre-orders for it. Something falls through. They don't get the import. They've now taken all this money from people. And now they're in trouble. So always do your due diligence. Sure, find out. I find new vendors sometimes by seeing YouTube videos pop up. That's sometimes like, oh, I've never heard of these guys before. Let me look into it. And then the real research starts. Remember, guys, don't take information from just anybody. I tell people, don't just take information from me. I try to be a trusted source of tarantula information, whether it be products that I see out there. And usually when I promote products, it's ones I'm spending my money on and I really want to share it along. But I tell people, see what other people say. When I give husbandry advice, I say, don't just take mine. Look and see what other people are doing. Find out what works for you. I think that's always important. So please, I know we got some awesome people out there doing these videos. They have a following. They have fans, but they're not infallible. And we should always keep in the back of our mind that for some of them, this is a business. This is how they make money. And every time money is involved, you know, sometimes ethics go right out the window. So in this case here, I always warn people, when you hear about a new dealer, do your research. I'm not saying don't give new people a shot. That would be terrible. I've done it. I will do it sometimes, see a new dealer, and I will order to just kind of see how they're, what they're about, and try to get word out. But at the end of the day, you got to make sure you do your research and that you look things up, and that just like when you're shopping anywhere, look at those negative reviews, see if there are trends. If there are trends, you may want to hold out. Number 17, Tim lives in Florida and is starting a modest tarantula collection. He has an extra room in his house that doesn't have air conditioning, so he thinks that this would be a great place to keep his spiders. After doing some research, he picks up a juvenile Avicularia versicolor and Lazidora parahibana. He reads that both of these species need some humidity and higher temperatures. Luckily, the room he's keeping them in is usually around 80 to 85 degrees, so he has the perfect temps. As for the moisture requirements, he reads a couple of care sheets that said they need moist substrate, water dishes, and need to be sprayed twice a week. He sets both spiders up a moist sub and is careful to spray down their enclosures every other day. Where is Tim going wrong here? This is kind of an extreme example because there's one thing that people sometimes fail to take into account. Now, granted, there's a couple wrong things right off the bat because we know for a factor a lot of us keep our Avicularia species more on the dry side. They need good cross ventilation. They don't need good high humidity. I just received yesterday, within about 20 minutes of each other, comments about Avicularia saying two people lost them because they heard they need to be kept super moist. They had them moist and they ended up with dead spiders. So right away, we have a situation here, at least with the Avicularia versicolor, that those conditions sound off. Number one, he's in Florida. He's keeping the spiders in a room that is not air conditioned. So temperature wise, it's fine. I balk at the fact where he reads that they usually need to be kept higher with higher temperatures. That's not true. As we've talked about many, many times, tarantulas can do well at room temperature. We're talking about, you know, mid to high 60s or so, and they do perfectly fine. They might just grow a little more slowly. But what he is missing here is the fact that because he's in Florida, they have naturally humid weather. This is a room that is not air conditioned. I've run into this with people from Florida, from people from the Philippines before, that they automatically have an environment in their home, especially because the room's not air conditioned. That's the key factor here. They have the environment in their home that they've already got high moisture levels. They've already got heat. So when he goes through and he's moistening the substrate and he's putting the water dish in and he's spraying, this is overkill. This is overcaring for the tarantulas. Now the L. parahibana, those are tough, tough spiders. So this one will probably do fine. But even what I'm reading here in this scenario, these would be dank conditions for that spider. I wouldn't be surprised if that spider started suffering health-wise from the overly moist conditions. You need to keep in mind where you're at and what the weather is at, like outside, for wherever you live when you're setting up your tarantulas. So if I come on and it's wintertime and I'm pouring a bunch of water into my tarantula cages, trying to keep them super moist, I've got the water dish filled up, I'm moistening up everything, that's because it's wintertime, my tarantula room, it's really dry. If you're currently in a place that's really humid naturally, you don't have to worry as much about this. As a matter of fact, as I've mentioned before, because we're in a state where we kind of get, it gets really cold and dry during the winter, but it can be really humid and warm during the summer. During the summertime is when I let a lot of my species dry out a bit. It doesn't mean I let them go bone dry, but I keep a water dish in there. I keep a moist corner, but I let a lot of the substrate dry out because they're already getting that moisture in the air that they need. It's already a moist environment. You don't want to overkill it. And that's always important, whether you're listening to husbandry information from me or from whatever, whoever you're listening to, keep in mind where they're at, what the conditions are where they're at, and whether or not you may need to tweak that husbandry a bit to fit where you are. So again, I bring this one up only because I do get a lot of folks that are in naturally humid areas. I just had somebody from the Philippines the other day that's like, hey, I have the spider and I'm keeping the substrate really moist and I'm spraying it down. And I asked what the humidity was where he was, and it was 90% humidity. So overkill. You don't have to do it. So always keep that in mind when setting up your spiders, where you live, what time of year it is. Wintertime could be drier, summertime could be moist. Some people just have the perfect weather for it. There are people out there that live in places that naturally have the perfect climate for raising up tarantulas. And if that's the case, you need to be aware of that and need to adjust your husbandry accordingly. So number 18, last one on the list, Rosa is shopping at Petco when she notices that they are selling tarantulas. When she checks out what they have to offer, she's excited to see that they have an adult female curly hair tarantula on sale for $70. She snatches the spider up, sets it up in an appropriate enclosure, and is super pleased with her purchase. Several weeks later, she notices the spider digging out its burrow and seemingly doing some heavy webbing. She is shocked a few days later to find that her girl has an egg sac. After doing some research, she comes to the conclusion that this is a phantom sac, as she has never paired her lady, and she considers pulling the sack and tossing it in the garbage. Why shouldn't she do this? Well, I put this one on here because sadly this seems to be happening quite a bit lately, and in the U.S., a lot of folks are buying tarantulas from pet stores, from expos, and these tarantulas are laying egg sacs. Now, I have had many species that I've raised from slings do phantom egg sacs. It can happen. It's basically when the tarantula creates an egg sac, but it's not a viable sac. They have not been paired. Usually what happens is after a few days, a couple weeks, they end up eating the sac and they tear it up and they start eating again. It's fine. However, I've heard of several instances, one actually involving a curly hair, a T. albopilosis, a couple with a fauna pelma species where they get the spiders, they lay a sac, and the sac is viable. Meaning, sadly, these were wild caught specimens. And it's happened. I've seen it happen in videos. Somebody a ways back bought a P. metallica and it was gravid, one of the worst situations I've ever seen, because there is a critically endangered tarantula that was obviously pulled out of the wild. And not only did they lose one spider out of the wild, they lost all the potential for those babies in the wild. So sadly, this is still happening. We are still, the fact that we're still getting species like this, I mean, a fauna pelma, I think in the US, people are, they're becoming more and more popular, so they're getting plucked from the wild more often. There should never be a gravid female plucked from the wild. I'm sorry. We shouldn't be doing it. We can breed them. We can raise them. I know there are folks out there that pair them and breed them. That shouldn't be an issue. A T. albopilosis, those have been readily available in the hobby for years. I don't understand why anybody is pulling them out of the wild. But the sad truth is we are still getting shipments in from overseas and from other places that include wild caught specimens. And when you get a wild caught specimen that is gravid, that's an extra terrible thing, because those are babies that are not going to grow up in the wild. So the bad side of it is, obviously, we're still getting these wild-caught specimens in. For the people that are getting these phantom sacs when they're buying the adults, I tell them, treat it like it's a real sac. Look up the information on it, figure out when to pull it, and just in case, pull the sac when it's time and make sure that you don't have viable eggs with legs or babies at that point, because you never know. I would hate to have people, it would be an even more of a crime if, in my opinion, if somebody were to have that wild-caught specimen that does have a viable sac and they take it and throw it in the garbage and end up losing all those babies. And two of these instances, the people have taken the sacs, raised them up, had the babies, and they sold the babies off, so at least there's more babies in the trade. Again, still a terrible thing, but at least the babies don't get wasted. So this is something to keep in mind, something that people need to be aware of, because I've heard many instances where people are like, oh, it's a phantom sac, I've never paired them, and they rip it out, throw it in the garbage, and you just never know. So that does it for this one. Holy crud, an hour and 15 minutes. You guys, let me know what you think about the longer podcasts. I know they've been longer lately. My goal was always to keep them around 30 to 40 minutes back in the day, and then more closer to 40 minutes, but they've gotten a little bit longer. If you guys are okay with those, I'll continue keeping. I mean, they're not all going to be this long, but we'll see how it goes. Hopefully you all did well on this one, a little bit different than the previous ones, but hopefully we got some good information, some food for thought. Please chime in with how you know, if you want to chime in with how you did, if you want to chime in with some examples of, you know, that you've experienced that I actually shared in here, because I think a lot of us can, a lot of these are pulled from not only information I get from other people and comments I get from other people, but things that I've gone through myself. So that will do it for this one. If you want to check out my latest YouTube video for folks that were kind of interested on my last video with the curtain web spiders, the Diplurridae, we did rehouse my Linotheli phallix. It was quite the trip. Poor Billy got jump scared big time. I got startled too. The spider, I was trying to get it out one way, it shot out the other way, but I had warned Billy ahead of time that this spider is fast. She had been kind of dreading it. We mic'd her up because I had a funny feeling we'd have some, at least some humorous comments from her, and we did get kind of a funny interaction. It all went well though. Billy did not have a heart attack, thank God, because she was really freaked out, and the spider got into its new enclosure. It's doing great. I checked on it this morning. It's webbed all up. So if you want to check that out, see how big these guys can get. This female is 5 inches long. This is a 5-inch, not a tarantula spider. Beautiful animal, and I got some good footage of it afterwards that show off its blues. So you can check that out there. If you want to leave a comment, the comments have really been starting to pile up on Spotify. I think people are really enjoying. They can go there and comment, and I have been trying to keep an eye on that. You can also comment on my website, Tom's Big Spiders, the podcast, Tom's Big Spiders podcast, not the podcast. That would send you to a different site. Tom'sBigSpidersPodcast.com. Feel free to leave comments there. As always, guys, thanks for joining me. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you all next time.